BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
You're listening to A Point of View, a personal essay from a leading writer. Here's Rebecca Stott.
One day last October, as temperatures dropped, V-shaped formations of Canada geese began flying over Lewis, the town where I live, all heading south. I'd never seen so many birds. They just kept on coming, one skein after another, hundreds of them, flying so low over the high street that you could see the texture of their feathers. Over the cinema they flew, over the brewery, the Lido, the cobbled streets, the castle, following the river south. It might have looked like a scene from Hitchcock's The Birds, were it not for the sound of joyful honking. All along the narrow high street, pedestrians stopped and tipped their heads back to watch the extraordinary spectacle. Excited conversations broke out. Where were the birds going? Were they arriving or leaving? And we all took a breath as we contemplated the energy and unstoppability of nature. But puzzlingly, at dusk, when I ventured back along the high street to post a parcel, the geese reappeared in the same huge numbers. This time they were flying directly north, just as noisy, just as raucous. Were they lost? The man in the post office asked. Had they changed their minds about heading south? Why would they do that? For 10 more days, this huge colony of geese, around 900 on one estimate, flew south around 9 in the morning and north at around 4 in the afternoon. Everywhere I went in my hometown, every meeting, every cafe, every walk, all across the local Facebook pages, people were talking about the geese. When I ran into a friend, a local wildlife expert, a few days later, I asked her what was going on. Was it a sign that nature was even more out of kilter than we thought? She laughed. Almost all Canada geese living in the UK stay here all through the year now, she said. They'll roost in the same place, but move between different wetlands and marshes to feed during the day. The birds I'd seen, she said, were probably the geese that roosted on the Ardingly Reservoir to the north. They might have been trying out the flooded fields and wetlands to the south, doing a recce. Who knows, she said. They may just have been restless. Then she began to tell me about the 9 white storks that had been satellite tagged last summer in a rewilding project based on the Knepp Estate in Sussex. The very first storks, donated to the White Stork Project by a zoo in Warsaw, had been injured in collisions with power lines and cars and were unable to fly. The big question was, would their offspring know how to migrate if their parents weren't showing them the way? She showed me an interactive map on her computer. It traced the movements of the 9 young storks as they crisscrossed the south coast back and forth, all down the coastline, all through the summer. I imagined them on the rooftops of seaside houses staring out to sea. As the temperatures began to cool into September and October, suddenly the map showed one of them out on the open sea. Then another. Over the following days, some of those young birds made it all the way down over France and Spain into North Africa to overwinter at some of the great stork colonies there. In 3 to 4 years' time, my friend said, some of those young birds will return to exactly the same field in Sussex to breed. As I walked the boardwalks and muddy tracks of the River Ouse floodplains a few days ago, admiring the geese that have taken up winter residence there, my mind wandered to Aristotle, who studied bird migration on the island of Lesbos in the Aegean Sea as long ago as 344 BCE. For 2 years he recorded the migration patterns of cranes, pelicans, geese, cuckoos, quails and swans, observing when they arrived, when they left, how much weight they put on before they started their epic journeys. Many years later, after a decade spent tutoring the young Alexander the Great, he turned his detailed studies of fish and birds into the first great works of biology and zoology. Aristotle didn't have access to the technology of the modern ornithologist. It's not surprising that he made a mistake or two. He claimed that swallows and kites, for instance, hibernate at the bottom of rivers in the winter and that redshanks transmute into robins. But nonetheless, he defined many of the key questions about migration that are still being explored by international teams of zoologists today. He would have been astonished by the discoveries of modern researchers, that birds have inbuilt compasses, for instance, that enable them to sense and follow geomagnetic fields. I can't help thinking that there may have been personal reasons for Aristotle to be so fascinated by the great mysteries of bird migration, because when he walked the lagoons of Lesbos, he was himself a migrant, not just a migrant, but a political refugee. In 346 BC, when he was around 30, doing well for himself, living in Athens and teaching at Plato's Academy, even tipped as Plato's successor, Philip of Macedonia attacked a city under the protection of Athens. In the wake of Philip's attack, xenophobic slogans appeared on the city walls. Athenian yobs threw rotting food at resident Macedonians and attacked their property. Aristotle, Macedonian by birth, knew his time was up. War or no war, fame or no fame, he knew he'd always be a second-class citizen in Athens. Life as an immigrant, especially one from the supposedly barbaric north, would always be dangerous. As a metic, the Greek word for immigrant, he had no right to vote, hold office, own property, but now he feared for his life. Imagine Aristotle, future teacher of Alexander the Great, one of the most important intellectuals in human history, standing on a port wall at night with a few belongings, trying to find a boat. How long did he have to wait with the hundreds of other Macedonians who would have crowded there with their families? How long was he out on the open sea in that boat? We don't know. He turns up again, months later, on the other side of the Aegean Sea in Assos, on the coast of Asia Minor, in the court of a wealthy benefactor called Hermias, a former slave and friend of Aristotle's family, a man who had done well and now prided himself on the civilized values of his court. Hermias granted Aristotle asylum. No questions asked, no conditions. As a consequence, Aristotle survived and flourished. 12 years later, he returned to Athens. He founded the Lyceum. He published his great works, books on logic, metaphysics, mathematics, biology, botany, ethics, politics, and the arts. But none of this would be enough to alter his status as an immigrant living in a profoundly xenophobic city. A further wave of anti-Macedonian feeling, this time even more paranoid and more violent, forced him out of the city again. He made another second flight to sea. He died in exile on the island of Chalcis a few months later. I've been thinking of Aristotle again as I've watched the images of expulsions, roundups, raids, incarcerations and detention camps on the news. Experts claim that we are now living through an age of global mass migration brought about by poverty, violence, famine, war, ethnic cleansing and climate change. Others warn that we expel migrants at our peril. Birth rates are plummeting in the richest countries. We are all living longer. Our ratios of workers to retirees are dwindling fast. Sweden is already desperately short of loggers. Italy badly needs plumbers. All European countries are struggling to find enough care workers. In the coming decades, many countries that are now expelling migrants could well find themselves in urgent competition to attract them. The migration of people, even or especially under duress, is inextricably linked with human progress, Lydia Polgreen claimed in an article in the New York Times last week. It cited the 142 Nobel Prize winners who were also immigrants. Migration is fundamentally kindled by the fire of human aspiration, she wrote. It can never fully be snuffed out. Meanwhile, spring is on the way. In a few weeks, the first birds will be arriving from southern Europe and North Africa, the wheatears followed by the sand martins. By April, we'll hear the calls of the first cuckoos and then the high-pitched calls of the swifts returning from the Congo. It's really dangerous out there, my friend, the wildlife expert, says, reminding me of all the hazards those birds will be facing right now as they start to make their way north, following rivers, mountain ranges, geomagnetic fields, constellations of stars or coastlines. The light pollution, the wind farms, the predators and hunters, the storms and oil spills. The ones that get here, the ones that survive, will always have stories to tell.
I'm Alex Krotowski.
And I'm Kevin Fong.
How do you feel about AI?
Does it scare you?
Very quickly, that question comes up. You know, is it going to think for us?
Does it excite you?
I say, how is the AI going to help us to think better?
Do you worry about how it'll change your life, your job, your kids?
AI is built into many of the software applications that we now use in the schools every day.
In every episode of The Artificial Human from BBC Radio 4, Kevin and I are here to help. We will chart a course through the world of AI and we will answer your questions.
It doesn't just lie, but it lies in an incredibly enthusiastic, convincing way. That ability to be able to kind of think critically is just going to be so important as we move forwards.
The Artificial Human with me, Alex Kratosky.
And me, Kevin Fong.
Listen on BBC Sounds.